Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 693.JB2801, certificate number 15845. The Kruger Millions.
Go!
Kruger.
Now, last week, our episode on the cyber sin. A story of Allende in Chile.
Techno-Marxism.
You and I both made some comments that might confuse people in terms of whether or not you and I are compatible with Marxism.
They're probably still arguing about it. At least you've got that Trotsky-like beard.
Yeah, well, and my history of working for oppressed peoples.
Of course. Uncontacted, except for by you.
Now, how do you think we feel about colonialism?
Boy, I gotta say, not compatible with Marxism, in my humble opinion.
Right, although the Marxists have certainly done their share of colonizing.
They're kind of, some of them are doing it right now. I guess China doesn't count as Marxist anymore.
Oh, right. Marxo-capitalist? What are they? Mao, they're not Maoists either, right? Didn't they disavow all that?
You can't really say they're Mao anything, because it's very hard to pronounce the word Mao.
Mao.
Mowage is what brings us here today.
That is the second Mowage reference I've heard in 2 days.
Was it me the first time?
No, it's a little Bader-Meinhoff-y.
I would say we are super anti-colonialists.
Super duper anti-colonialists.
That said, like, I've probably gone on vacations places that made me kind of
Go ahead.
At least profiting off of
this is a safe zone. You can confess your sins.
Made me a colonialist. Fine.
Have you?
I was a white guy in Hawaii.
Have you ever done a? Have you ever done a safari?
I have not.
Right.
I kind of want to.
You went down to the colony of Antarctica.
I've been to Antarctica. All the penguins are no longer uncontacted.
Mm-hmm.
They've been contacted by me. We were not allowed to go touch them, but if we stood still and they came to us, you could do that.
Oh, really? Did they come to you?
They do, in fact.
Did you touch them?
They're like childlike, noble savages of the tundra.
Isn't that terrible? That's very colonialist.
They thought I was like a god. They're like, who is this tall, hairy Jesus?
And is it true that they smell like poo and pee?
The poo is everywhere. And it's fish. It's fish poo. And so you can tell what they've been eating by just what color the ice is. Like every colony of penguins will just be sitting on, it's all beautiful pastels because it's landed on white snow.
Oh, I see.
But it might be kind of bluish gray. It might be greenish. It might be reddish, depending on if they're eating, you know, shrimp that has those little. So yeah,
so it's a rainbow flag.
The ice will be a beautiful pink. Yeah, exactly. Antarctica is super gay.
Uh-huh.
We all know penguins are gay. Those ones in the Central Park Zoo were.
Totally documented. Well, today's story does involve
gay penguins.
A lot of gay penguins, but also a fair amount of colonialism.
There's penguins in South Africa.
There are.
Probably not super relevant to the story.
There are penguins, yeah, the penguins that got lost and then stayed, basically colonizing.
Oh.
Africa and South America.
Are you saying there should be a back to Antarctica movement?
No, I'm just wondering whether those big penguins, and those are the big ones, right? The big ones are the ones that come and take food from the mouths of resident flightless birds.
The emperor penguins I saw were not the ones that were far north, so I don't know.
Crested, tufted ones?
I think it's all the weird-looking ones that are just hanging out in random temperate places in Africa and South America. Like, why are you guys? You're not. Well, you guys don't even seem like you're penguins.
That's what I'm saying.
Motion to rebrand you all as puffins.
Puffins, the state bird of Alaska.
Is that true?
Yeah. Also kind of a weird penguin-like creature.
It is, but why is it the state bird?
You don't find them very many other places.
Also, I think it's the willow ptarmigan, so I think I'm gonna Alaska splain to you. Do they have an official state seabird?
Let's see. Is the puffin a state bird?
The horned puffin is the most widely recognized of Alaska's seabirds and is most frequently seen on the souvenirs.
But you're saying that it's a ptarmigan?
I think the ptarmigan
It's a ptarmigan. How strange. Well,
But you're right that the horned puffin seems to be like the commercial symbol of Alaskan
yeah,
birds.
Yeah, we do a lot of puffin related
stuff. Oh, it's weird
stuff.
Looking.
It is funny bird.
It's kind of ominous looking. It's like a kabuki alien.
Yeah, the beak is formidable.
Yeah, and doesn't even look like a beak.
So apparently there are puffins on the Brittany coast of France.
Really?
But mostly it's Iceland, Greenland, and northern Russia. It says Iceland has 60% of the world's puffins. But in the United States, it really is Alaska and Maine.
It looks like the penguin species native to Africa is, in fact, the African penguin.
The African penguin.
Sometimes called the Cape penguin. It looks penguin-y, but like less so than a big... I mean, emperor penguins are...
Big.
Huge.
And regal.
And they're the ones that look canonically, penguin regal. These all kind of look shabby. Like every other penguin species is kind of like looks a little like a down-on-its-luck hobo penguin.
Hmm. I'm not sure any of the stuff we've said about penguins actually flies in today's culture because there's
nothing about penguins flies, John, famously.
Go ahead. Where's my bell? It's not around.
Can you follow this through?
You know, the problem is we got that great bell. I should have just dinged it, but
it's right in front of you.
My kid,
it's orange.
She, there we go.
Tape delay. 7-second tape delay.
What we're going to talk about today, Ken, is South Africa.
South Africa.
South Africa.
South Africa.
I'm from South Africa, Spalding. I can't drown.
I believed that Kruger's Millions was some kind of 80s comedy where Freddy Krueger would only inherit his grandpa's fortune if he could spend $1 million by end of day Friday.
Oh, I thought it was that he had to get married.
Yes.
Yes. He had Freddy to get married.
Freddy Krueger has to marry one of the Elm Street teens he's terrorizing to inherit his grandpa's fortune.
Or else he loses all the money.
That sounds pretty good. I'd watch that.
Do you know much about the history of South Africa?
I really don't.
Well, that's good.
Because there are a lot of Boers.
It's very boring.
Ding.
Thanks.
You're going to ding yourself?
No, I can't. You can't ding yourself.
Is it like tickling yourself?
No, I take that away. Don't let me ding myself. But it's a very torturous history. But I'm going to give you just a tiny thumbnail sketch of it. We've talked a lot about the trade routes around the Horn. And
we're constantly talking about the trade routes around the Horn.
And the trade routes around the Cape of Good Hope,
from Europe to India.
Europe to India and and elsewhere.
Points beyond.
And the real pioneers of that route were the Portuguese, but then later the Dutch East India Company did a lot of business going around the Cape and headed over to Indonesia and their other colonies far and wide. And so the Dutch East India Company started issuing land grants to Dutch settlers in the 17th century, and a whole lot of Dutch farmers settled in what became, the sort of South African, initially there around the coast, and then increasingly further inland.
All places inhabited by...
Zulus and various other South African
pre-existing peoples,
and it was sort of a breadbasket. They sent a lot of food supplies back to the Nederlands. But then, of course, the British got into the Sail Around the World Act and the Sail Around the Cape of Good Hope Act. As you can probably guess, it wasn't the Cape of Good Hope until the British put the English spin on it.
How do you say that in Dutch? De Cape der Gordon.
There you go. Hoopie. The Cape der Gordon. Herpaderp.
That's right.
The Herpaderp.
And the Swedish chef was also on some of these boats.
So the British, you know, started to, well, they kicked the Dutch off of the Cape itself and gradually sort of put a little British enclave there in the south. The Dutch didn't like it one single bit.
They're always doing that. They're always putting little Gibraltars wherever they go.
That's right. They love to do a Gibraltar. And the Dutch people that had, by that point in time, been living there for a couple hundred years, felt like they had, that they were, at that point, the indigenous population.
Exactly. Hey, we were here first, in quotes.
Yeah, and they really resisted British authority. The Dutch settlers were all sort of part of the Calvinist school of Dutch colony.
Then shouldn't they think they deserved it?
We've been predestined
to get our ass kicked by the British.
But they were, you know, they were doctrinaire, sort of. It was a devout, like, religious community.
Puritan fundamentalists?
Yeah, that's right. And they didn't like the British coming in with all of their tea and
merriment.
And so gradually the Dutch population started to leave the coastal cities to get away from English rule, and they moved to the northeast and started to, you know, colonize more inland parts of the Netherlands. And the one
not
thing,
of the Netherlands.
I'm sorry, the more inland parts of
to them it was Netherlands.
We call South Africa
a little bit of England.
And like a lot of religious communities, the only people they hated more than the English were each other, and they formed several different communities that then tried to become sort of independent countries. They would form a little nation state, and then there would be a schism between the top two ministers, and then the new one would go form a new nation state. Not all of them succeeded, but in the end, there were two large, sort of predominantly Dutch or exclusively Dutch states in sort of north, central, and eastern South Africa, what became South Africa.
And they basically started out as just warring Amish?
Yeah, Amish that were trying to get away from the British and also fighting one another.
Other Amish.
The Transvaal and the Orange Free State were the two largest of those communities. Mm-hmm. And the British, in their inimitable way, continued to encroach. But then, and we've seen this many times before as part of a colonial backstory, in 1886, gold was discovered in an area that then encompasses these Dutch communities.
Oh, it's in the Dutch part.
Yeah. And a gold rush began called the Witwatersrand gold rush. And like so many other colonial misadventures, the British, hoi polloi, the prospectors and adventurers, started to arrive from England and Australia to exploit this gold rush. And the Boers, the Dutch settlers.
Those were the Dutch farmers.
Cast themselves in the role of the American Indians in the Black Hills in this story. And all of these outsiders were coming in and ruining their happy camps.
Their sacred dances and rituals.
That's right. That's right. And yeah, their sacred mountains, the British were despoiling them. And the British in their colonial way, I mean, you know, of course, there was a vast population of actual native Africans here that were
their story is like missing from the record,
not really being told in light of this what became the Boer Wars, although, you know, there were also big battles between the Zulus.
Must have outnumbered British. The British and the Dutch at least for a while.
They did, and one of the things that the Dutch really hated about the influx of the British is the British had, and this, now you're going to feel, I think, very conflicted here about whose side you're on. The British moved in they took over Cape of Good Hope in 1806, but in the 1830s, there along the coast, they prohibited teaching in the Dutch language.
Oh.
And of course, the Dutch language was what all the Bibles were written in, and they're a devout culture.
This is how you treat an indigenous population.
But then here's what they in 1834. You may remember this from the story of the United States. They abolished slavery.
Oh,
they abolished slavery worldwide in the British sphere of influence.
So I have to figure out what to do if somebody's doing a cultural genocide, but they're also against somebody that's doing a slavery genocide.
Right. So the Boers came in and took over South Africa and enslaved some portion of the native population.
So they're Amish slave owners. I know they're not really Amish.
Not all of them, but the big plantations, right? Yeah. And so the British, unlike in, I think this wasn't what they always did, but they allocated 1,200,000 pounds as compensation for the freed slaves that they were willing to pay the Dutch.
They were paying the Dutch.
They were going to pay the Dutch.
Because if you were a British settler, you were not allowed to own slaves, period.
No slaves.
This
was just sort of a big government sort of peacekeeping, you know, keep the peace on the streets. We'll give you this amount for your slaves.
The slaves, of course, now how much reparation did the slaves get, John?
That would, I think, in general, be zero amount.
Followed by 10.
And the Boers were not satisfied with that payment amount because they felt that the value of their lost slaves was much greater than 1,000,002
right.
pounds. So this was at the heart of the disagreements between the two groups never suffered from a loss of rationale. But the difference between the two cultures was highlighted by this freeing of the slaves. And so the Boer exodus actually became a major part of the founding story of the Boer nation that then became integrated into the greater nation of South Africa after the Boer Wars, as we'll see.
Are you saying a bunch of Boers took off, like they headed back to Europe?
Or? No, not back to Europe, out into the Transvaal and forming the Orange Free State.
They just head north.
And they called that the Great Trek.
Right.
So it was a...
this is their founding frontier narrative.
Yeah, right.
We conquered the wilderness.
A diaspora from their former turf. So... I could bore you for 1,000 episodes of Omnibus trying to describe all of the ins and outs of the British and the Boers and their disagreements over how to govern South Africa.
Let's start a new spin-off podcast called Bore Me John, B-O-E-R, where every week you try to find something incredibly esoteric about South African 19th century history.
Yeah, a lot going on, a lot of different and conflicting ideas about how to govern these woolly people, the Boers, and then the whole British colonial enterprise.
Do the British see them as less civilized?
Absolutely.
They're like, these guys are, and probably because they were they less educated? Are they like poor, marginalized Europeans who are becoming, you know, couldn't farm profitably there? Are they the same outcasts that would have come to the New World? Or?
I think, at first they were part of just the Dutch colonial enterprise. Who leaves the home country and goes off? Either adventurers or people that can't cut it.
Or religious.
Right.
What do you call it? Iconoclasts.
The titular hero of our story.
Mr. Kruger.
Paul Kruger.
M. Illion.
Was born in 1825.
Doesn't he write for the New York Times now?
Yeah, Paul Kruger. He's a neoconservative.
The world is flat.
Actually, the Paul Kruger of our story did believe the world was flat
for different reasons.
He grew up there and as a young child was part of the Great Trek, and so really identified with the story. You know, he was in some ways kind of a later a personification of the story of the Western founding, you know, settler myth. By all accounts, he only had ever read the Bible, not especially educated, not worldly.
Like, you mean he'd never read anything else?
Right.
It's not that that's the only thing he'd ever done, or the only thing he had done to the Bible.
Who knows what he did to the Bible?
He had only ever read the Bible.
It's very lonely out there.
Many of us have scratched our backs with it or used it to prop up a vase.
Depending on how big the Bibles are. Yeah. And actually, a Bible figures into the story later here, too. And he was part, initially, you know, not against the British in particular. All the crimes the British kept sort of committing, you know, a lot of them bureaucratic administrative crimes against the Boers as they, you know, gradually infiltrated and took over.
Not the kind of things we get up in arms about today, not war crimes or?
No. He was mostly, you know, Kruger was part of a delegation of Boers that were trying to negotiate with the British. He actually traveled to England and to Holland and was...
He's like the Pocahontas type of his indigenous
people.
He's
a little bit of a Pocahontas. He was universally described as gross. Like,
is that just British racism?
Somewhat.
It's pretty funny that you can be racist against the Dutch.
Yeah. Well, and he was...
You know who's clearly a backward, benighted people. They live like 200 miles away, and they just sound like us with a weird accent. But the Dutch.
And they're very tall. But he was not especially tall. He was short and, you know, dark hair. He was often described as greasy, sort of.
I guess this is the kind of, you know, racism we did in the early 20th century against Italians.
Yeah, and Catholics.
Yeah.
And the fact that he was, you know, a radical Presbyterian or whatever didn't help him. But the British loved to caricature their opponents. I mean, they're why we think Napoleon was short. Mm-hmm. And they did the same thing to Kruger. But all firsthand accounts of having dinner with him or negotiating with him said that he, you know, his dirty coat was covered with dandruff, and he spent half of this formal dinner just sitting there combing nits out of his hair.
It is funny that that's like maybe the most civilized guy the Boers could find.
Yeah, well,
like back there, he's some monocle wearing aristocrat, but
and he was he became a hero and a founding father of the Boer. Story, but for most of his career, he believed that there could be a rapprochement between the Boers and England. He kept thinking that the English were just didn't get it, mm-hmm. you know, and he needed to go and explain it to them. He famously did believe the world was flat.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and at one point was on some.
That seems hard to believe. A hard thing to believe even in the 1830s.
Yeah, although, well, and this was quite a bit later than the 1830s. Where are we now? We're in the 1880s.
Oh.
But he, again, had not studied, had no exposure to those ideas, very rural life, and taking this trip to England, you know, overheard a couple of young students talking about Pythagoras or whatever and said, you know, if the world is round, then I might as well just throw my Bible off the, you know, over the side right now.
If you're Dutch, your land is flat. It right. comes from the flattest place on earth.
But, you know,
the Dutch could be easily fooled.
Were some of the early people to have figured out the world was round, given their long experience sailing around it.
Apparently it was lost technology like Greek fire.
Well, it's the difference between the Dutch and the Boers, I guess.
Yeah.
The only real Boers I've ever met, I was in a youth hostel in Amsterdam. And, you know, if you stay a long time in a youth hostel, you see a lot of turnover.
Yeah.
Right? You get your bed and you stick your little icons around it and you hide an apple in your sheets. And there are a bunch of kids there for the weekend that are all from Sweden. And then they're all gone on Monday. And then on Tuesday, a new bunch arrives. And I frequently would kind of take up station in a youth hostel and stay for a little while. And
does that make you the coolest one or the least cool one?
Well, the coolest ones are the ones that do that until they get a job at the youth hostel, and then they move to a different room and start living
there.
It's like
becoming a camp counselor.
Yeah, and then you're working the front desk or you're serving up a vegetarian lunches. I never got to that point. At one point, I think at Bob's youth hostel in Amsterdam, I worked for a day or two, but, you know, didn't work out between us.
It's just because you couldn't pay the bill.
But I remember a group of South African students, like, you know, five dudes my age, all showed up 1 week, and I spent kind of a week with them. And they were surprisingly wild relative to, like, you know, untamed. And according to them, their accent was so unintelligible to the Dutch that they could speak freely in Dutch anywhere they went and no one understood a word they said, but they understood spoken, you know, Dutch in the Amsterdam dialect perfectly. So they had that secret agent quality of being able to know what everyone was saying, but be unintelligible, kind of like the Swiss Germans.
And they wouldn't say Boers today, right? They'd be Afrikaners or something?
Afrikaners,
Boers are like the historical forebears. That's not still the ethnic group,
no,
right?
No, I don't think they would. They would say Afrikaners. And this was in the, what? So it would have been in the 80s, so still.
Did you ask them what the shape of the earth was?
Nope, never came up. But it would have been still in a time, you know, we ain't going to play Sun City era.
Right.
So they had a vibe of forbidden, dangerous outlanders.
Is the idea that, you know, they're the, like, was the idea that if you're a young person from a young Afrikaner back then, you're, are you sympathetic to your apartheid regime?
You know, that came up in conversation, and they really, like, smirkingly dodged the conversation, like, did not jump in to disavow,
right? Like, oh, apartheid. No, like, we're the cool young activist white kids.
No, they didn't do that. Yeah. They, you know, they smirked and rolled their eyes and were like, oh, you know, like, you don't want to know type of thing. And I was like, actually, I really am interested. And they're like, let's, you know, let's duck in here and have seven beers. So no, they never gave me the full story, and which I thought at the time was a pretty good indicator of
probably lets
where
you know
they stood. The Transvaal and Orange Free State were recognized by the international communities. They were formally accepted as nations of the free world. But the British didn't relent, and so thus began what became the Boer Wars.
Does Britain actually claim this territory?
Well, it does now. At this point, and now we're talking about the end of the 19th century. They do, you know, decide that there are enough diamonds and gold, and a few enough problematic Dutch that they can, that they're better off assuming control. Paul Kruger at this point is president of Transvaal, which was named the South African Republic, and is kind of the preeminent statesman of the Boer people.
Despite the fact that he's still got food and bugs in his beard?
Yeah, he's still pretty greasy.
Wild and woolly.
And for a time, you know, feels like he's going to, because his nation has been recognized by the global community, he feels like he's going to be able to, you know, gather together international support in his fight against the British. And so he holds out hope and begins stockpiling gold and diamonds as part of a plan to pay for mercenary armies and support and supply what he hopes will be, we're talking about, you know, 1900, what he hopes will be some interested parties, right? The Portuguese are right there in Mozambique. The Germans always trying to make inroads into Africa. Mm-hmm. The Dutch themselves, the Dutch government, like, there are a lot of, he has a lot of options to put together a coalition to fight the British.
And I assume that's why these nations have recognized the Transvaal, right? They're just lining up to complicate British geopolitical power in Africa.
Nobody likes the British, but also, you know, they're recognizing Transvaal because they want to trade with them for gold and diamonds and wheat and whatever else, right? It's a rich country.
Because of the gold rush.
Yeah, and the nations of the world want in on it. But in 1900, Paul Kruger realizes that the jig is up. And in September of that year, he flees to Mozambique on a train.
Because of military defeats?
Because the British are...
The British are coming.
Looming over Johannesburg.
And he couldn't produce his mercenary army.
Well, so his plan was to go to Mozambique and then, you know, stage a resistance or a rebel army from there.
Yeah.
And he gets there and the Portuguese aren't hip to it. They put him in jail and eventually release him, and he flees on a Dutch ship to Marseille, and from there to the Netherlands, and ultimately to Switzerland.
Is he still president in exile?
President in exile, but the British completely conquer South Africa and turn it into the nation of South Africa that we see.
Well, not the one we see today.
But. Some version of it that became the version of it that became the version of it that became some version of the nation that we see today.
The white apartheid version of the nation we see.
That's right. The apartheid system, which was very much a Boer mentality, then became the governing system, you know, the governing...
If it's the one thing that the British and the Dutch can agree on, right? We do not want any native power or...
Keep the locals out of the government. That's right. At the time, there was Paul Kruger had been stockpiling the gold and diamonds that that were being produced in the Transvaal to the best of his ability. The government was minting coins with Kruger's face on them, gold, you know, sovereigns, what were called pawns or pounds.
They called pounds pawns?
Pawns. You know,
like the lotion.
Dutch like and English cream? Are the same language. It's just the Dutch didn't figure out how to pronounce it, and they don't have as many French words.
They don't have the letter U.
Yeah. So he was collecting this gold and diamond hoard in order to pay for this revolutionary army or mercenary army.
And is he out of Africa at this time, as it were?
So Kruger then was in Pretoria and had to escape the capital, and when the British colonial administrators arrived, there's one thing that they're good at, and that's doing an inventory.
Yeah, nation of shopkeepers.
And in doing the inventory, they realized that there were 2 million pounds, not the weight of pounds, but the cost, the currency pounds.
Pawns
of gold missing from the coffers. That would be 183,000 ounces of gold.
What did you do the modern day?
I did. That's conversion? Like $370 million worth of gold.
And are they going to paint this as him being an absconder or an embezzler?
Yes. He now has escaped with these great riches.
Is there any truth to that? Is he living high on the hog in Switzerland?
Well, when he got on, after he was released in Mozambique and got on the boat to Marseille, there was not 183,000 pounds of gold, or I'm sorry, 183,000 ounces of gold in his luggage.
Yeah, you got to declare that.
Yeah, there was no evidence that he took the hoard with him.
Mm.
And so there was a lot of speculation. Where did this huge quantity of gold go? 183,000 ounces. There's 12 ounces in a pound.
16
ounces in a pound.
So it's over 10,000 pounds. So over 5 tons of gold?
5 tons of gold.
That's a lot of gold. I don't know. Somebody should tell me what the volume of that much gold is. But
well, gold's very heavy.
Yes. So it could be that 5 tons of gold is just like the size of a...
fits in your satchel.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I'm sure 5 tons of anything is... I mean, that's a great band name, 5 tons of anything. But it's a lot more than he obviously left Africa with. Not to end a sentence in a preposition.
This seems like a metric ton would be a cube of gold, 37 centimeters on each side. So less than half a meter on each side.
Still, you couldn't put it in your suitcase.
Yeah. So, you know, imagine a cube. Yeah, it's like a little over a foot in each dimension.
No, wait, that can't possibly weigh 5 tons.
No, sorry, that's 1 metric ton.
Oh, I see, 1 ton.
So it would be like a large steamer trunk, maybe? That can't be 5 tons, can it?
I mean, you'd have to have quite a lot of people carrying it, and that would be...
Yes.
That would set off some alarm bells. Anyway, it's pretty clear that he didn't take it with him. In 1905, just a few short years later, only 5 years later, even, a man by the name of John Holzhauser, sound familiar?
No.
he was a contestant on Jeopardy, John Holzhauser.
It's Holzhauer with an extra Z.
Oh, yeah, Holzhauer, right. I always get that mixed up. But he was a guy, just like a petty criminal who got arrested, and in the process of talking to the fuzz, the cops there, he claimed to be the last of 3 South Africans who'd taken the gold and diamonds off the train.
Oh, wow.
And buried it in the area around the border with Mozambique, in an area near the Blyde River. He claimed to know the location of the missing millions, Kruger millions.
But I mean, this has got to be enough of a myth at the time that maybe this is the kind of thing you can just say to get out of jail.
Seems like there are multiple instances where, like for instance, Holzhauser, you know, took some cops and a search party to where he claimed to have buried the gold, and they found some/a gold coin.
Hmm. They really spread it around?
Yeah, right. They one
we
at a time.
Divided into gold coins.
Like
each
squirrels.
Each one 30 square feet.
They buried them. He couldn't find any hoard, but there was, you know, and this is the thing. These are reports from 1905 South Africa. So did they find some coins? Did that get reported?
Yeah.
That they found some coins? Did the police, you know, did somebody get some coins from somewhere else?
But this is only, is this 5 years after?
5 years later.
The hoard would have been hidden?
Yeah.
So it's not like it's got generations to spread out, you know?
No.
You'd think it would be there or not.
And, you know, whether or not Holzhauser was telling the truth, or whether he, telling the truth and didn't remember.
A little vague on the details.
Or was just a grifter.
Or if one of the other 2 guys made it back in time.
Right, and stole the gold. Unclear. The next that the Kruger hoard appears on the scene is after World War II, a man by the name of H.J. Lessing looks at... looks more carefully at a Bible that his father gave him, his father who had fought in the Boer Wars and was killed in the Boer Wars and had given his son the family Bible on his way out the door. Lessing realized that inside the cover of this Bible was stitched a map of this territory. And so he...
But not specifically a map to the treasure?
Well, a map to the treasure.
Oh, yeah. Like it's of the specific area where, is there an X?
It's sort of, the implication is there's an X. Enough that Lessing and a friend actually traveled to the Swaziland border. So, you know, this is an area where Mozambique, Swaziland, and the former territory of Transvaal and the Orange Free State all kind of intersect. Uh-huh. They travel to this area by the Swaziland border, and they actually find a cache of old ammo boxes, which are all broken apart, and some sovereigns, some pawns with Kruger's face on them.
Of the right.
Not enough to qualify as a hoard, but tantalizing.
But it indicates that the map story is maybe true?
Well, first of all, if you believe the story, and second of all, it really suggests that this gold hoard was carried there in these ammo crates, and then someone found them, broke them up, and stole the coins.
I was interviewing the head map librarian at the Library of Congress many years ago for a book, and I asked him what kind of questions he gets as the nation's map librarian. And he said, the number one question we get here is, where are the treasure maps?
Right.
People want to know where the pirate maps are for the buried treasure. And we have to tell them there is no recorded case in history of a pirate actually. I mean, pirates probably did bury treasure sometimes, but no one ever made a map. That's an innovation of Robert Louis Stevenson in Treasure Island.
Isn't that crazy?
So it never actually happened. But if, this is a later case where somebody, because if you do bury a big treasure in the desert, you may want to have a record of the local landmarks, So.
Well, and who was Lessing's father? And if he died in the Boer Wars, he could have been part of this party that buried the gold and then was, killed in the following days. Mm-hmm. There's not, like most treasure stories, there's never a connection where you can say, this map is here because it was drawn by this guy and in this guy's possession. And we searched in his library for it and found it. It always could be, this whole thing could also be a grift, right? Lessing could have gone out into the desert, buried these crates.
We've had that kind of story on the Onibus.
Yeah, we have.
Salt the hills with a little bit of gold to make your story see. Because honestly, a little gold is almost less believable. Like what? Who took most of the gold but was then like, it's too much trouble to go over there and get those.
Yeah, I think the picture they're trying to present is they were in a big hurry. They pulled all this gold out and, sure, a few coins dropped, but who cares relative to the great wealth that they absconded with? Not to say that Lessing is telling an untrue story, but he did not find the hoard. Now fast forward to 2001.
Wow.
A story comes out that in the 60s, a farming family of Zulus found a stash of 4,000 pounds of gold on their farming land.
4,000 pounds in weight?
What they found was 4,000 coins. So not 4,000 pounds, but 4,000 pawns.
That's still a ton of coins.
It's a lot of coins, 4,000 coins. And this family who lived in the Ermelo area had been selling them piecemeal since the 60s.
Oh, they had found it decades before.
They found it in the 60s, and they'd just been taking some coins into town and selling them,
Do you think that was like just a canny strategy of like to avoid attention?
Well, so they claim to have found 4,000 coins, but only then cop to having sold 400 of them. When this information came out, there was a mad sort of scramble of people trying to get to that area and prospect.
Probably what they were trying to avoid, because I assume their legal claim on the found gold is pretty good.
Well, they're laborers and not landowners.
Oh, interesting.
So they were keeping it a secret because, they would have
landlords,
probably lost
man.
It. Landlords is right.
That's the problem with landlords. They take your buried treasure that you dug up.
And what we didn't ever see was then all 4,000 coins arrive on the scene.
So this is just by their own account?
By their own account, they'd sold 400 of these coins, and I don't think all 400 of those could be you know, accounted for.
Yeah.
Certainly, if you had a group of laborers who kept coming to town with coins
antique
from 1899,
coins.
Solid gold coins, selling them, you know, somebody in the area would have gotten suspicious.
I mean, these are not related to what we think of as 20th century Krugerrands, right?
Well, the Krugerrand, which became an instrument of gold bullion that was sold globally. Mm-hmm. It's called the Krugerrand in honor of Paul Kruger.
But it's not from the same era or?
Not from the same era. It was a way to sell South African gold on the global market. And in the 70s and 80s, after gold again could be sold, remember, we talked about this in a past episode of Omnibus. It was illegal for a private citizen to own gold for much of the mid part of the 20th century.
Until when? The 70s or 80s?
Until, yeah, Nixon, right?
Huh.
So Krugerrands became a very, very popular way of owning and investing in gold. And at one point, I think, accounted for 80% of the total sale of gold. They were earning $60 million a year for the Republic of...
Was it illegal for Americans to do it? But the Americans would buy on Krugerrands anyway, just because of traceability?
So as part of the embargo against apartheid South Africa, it became illegal to own Krugerrands.
Huh.
Or, I'm sorry, illegal to buy Krugerrands. But there was there continued to be an international market for Krugerrands. And that was... I think you can recall, like, the Canadians started selling gold $20 pieces that were, you know, they're trying to,
why.
Yeah, trying to get in on that market.
They're just a signifier in, you know, 70s and 80s spy fiction and action thrillers of, the way to have your ghost ash.
Yeah.
Jason Bourne's got 6 passports and a stack of
Krugerrands. And
Krugerrands.
A belt of Krugerrands.
I'm looking at a Krugerrand here that has a Springbok or some other gazelle on one side, but the head is actually a profile of Paul Kruger himself, and he looks like the actor Philip Baker Hall, but with a bushy kind of Brigham Young beard.
Yeah.
He does look like the Amish fundamentalist with centipedes in his beard that you allude to.
Well, and the Rand was the dollar of South Africa during that time. But yeah, he's not...
And maybe still is. Did they rename it? I can't remember.
I think it is.
I think it's still the Rand, yeah.
He is not the handsomest guy, although the gazelle is certainly very beautiful.
He's not really, he's not the gazelle of settlers.
The current price of an ounce of gold is about $2,000.
Hmm.
And you can go online and buy Krugerrands. They still produce them. They've actually just recently started making silver Krugerrands.
But it's just a coincidence that they're named after this founding father who also happens to be the namesake of a lost treasure.
Well, no, because Kruger became a legendary... South Africa, controversial, but legendary Boer Afrikaans figure.
Yeah. But not because, not unrelated to the treasure is what I'm saying. It's just like putting Thomas Jefferson on a coin or?
Yeah, I guess that's right. I guess they're not commemorating but the thing was that the original Pons also had a profile of Kruger.
I see. So it's a kind of a replica.
Yeah, it's a continuation of, you know, ye olde monies. Well, so treasure hunters have been searching for the Kruger hoard this whole time. And over the years...
Like the whole time we've been talking?
That, and last also... Hour. Well, no, they're not looking for it now, but the whole 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
So much so that they were tearing up across
like
this
environmental
area.
Problems and angry ranchers
digging up graves, polluting waterways, looking for the treasure, to the point that some South African officials at one point lied and said there never was a hoard. It was only a handful of coins, and they've all been found. The whole thing wasn't worth 80 grand.
I feel like the lie to tell would be like, hey, we found it. Here it is. And have one of those drug bust photo ops.
Right.
With a bunch of replica coins. And then, do you think this is because, let me ask you this. Do you think this is all because treasure hunters are dopes? Like that if you were actually good at any of the skills you would need, you would probably not be a treasure hunter. So you just get a bunch of amateurs digging up the countryside.
Whenever I make any kind of comment to the effect that
I want you to get nasty letters from our treasure hunter listeners.
Well, I feel like it's a component of conspiracy theory. which is that rather than think that the simplest answer is probably closest to correct, there's always going to be somebody that thinks the most complex possible answer is probably correct. And so...
which in this case would be...
Well, the idea of a head of state collecting the wealth of the nation into bags and then loading them all onto a train and escaping in the night.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are lots of 20th and 21st century examples of autocrats looting the state coffers.
And then heading into exile, yeah.
If you think about the plot of the movie Three Kings, it was that Saddam Hussein had filled up all these Louis Vuitton bags with bars of gold. I think that happens. I mean, Putin has looted the Russian coffers, but it all went into a Swiss bank
account.
Putin has been looting. In this case, in 2021, a bank in Switzerland came forward and said that a depositor there who wished to remain anonymous had been storing in a Swiss vault 1,000 pounds that could be definitively connected to the Kruger hoard. And they had been there. They were moved to Switzerland in the era right before World War II.
Okay.
And before that had come from the Netherlands.
And why are they at liberty to say this now?
Because
had the depositor asked to have this made public?
Or? The depositor wanted to sell the coins.
Oh, okay.
And so the coins were actually bought. There was an argument made that they belonged to the South African
government,
mint.
The successor state of the Orange Free State or Transvaal.
And so a secret deal was made between the secret owner of these Kruger Pons.
It can't be much of a secret if we're revealing it on this podcast.
Well, the secret is the terms of the deal.
Oh, I see.
And the South African Mint. And the South African Mint has subsequently packaged these Kruger Pons along with some modern Kruger Rand coin in little display.
Oh, I see.
Franklin Mint
style. You can
style,
make more money by selling it as Franklin Mint.
With an authorized certificate and a facsimile of a bank bag from the era, and are selling them to collectors for, you know, thousands of dollars.
And now remind me, what percentage of the hoard would 1,000 coins be?
Well, if we think of 4,000 coins being about half of it. So this
it's a good chunk, but it's a chunk. It's not the whole missing mystery.
And in trying to track down how that got to the Netherlands, when it wasn't in anybody's suitcase, the story kind of started to reveal itself that Kruger had been sequestering money, but doing it the old-fashioned way, which was transferring it via the global economic system in the years prior to the Boer Wars.
He just had a bank account.
Yeah, this was a component of a bank deal. Every time the ships went back to Amsterdam, some money went into his Dutch bank, and including, you know, in the form of these actual coins.
Well, this is always the question about these buried treasures. Why are these weirdos keeping it in a mattress? Why don't they just have a nice interest-bearing account? And finally, we found one who did.
That's right.
Paul Kruger had a sensible retirement investment plan.
And interesting that someone in the Netherlands at the time accepted those deposits, but then didn't put the coins into some melting pot.
Kept them
separate with some anonymous family. Having bought them and retained ownership.
Because it's not the original depositor clearing the Swiss bank to hold this sale in 2021. It's obviously an estate or a family, right?
Right, the grandchild.
Yeah.
Did you ever have a coin collecting phase?
I would say not much. Like as a kid, I remember like stamp fascination. And trying to have coins of like pennies from every year.
Yeah.
But nothing where I actually had the expertise of like, oh, these are the years when quarters actually had silver. And this is the rare. I was aware that there were rare years with pennies. And I think enough that when I got a penny, I'd be like, could this be a buffalo? No, it's not. Or Indian head. No.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Aluminum penny.
But it is like the, you know, it is the hobby that's closest to a kid's idea of treasure hunting, I guess. Yeah. Were you a coin nerd?
I was in exactly the ways that you just described. I collected coins. I knew which ones were worth more than others. Uh-huh. And in the 70s, you'd still pick up any bunch of pocket change and
a few quarters,
find a couple silver quarters. Mm-hmm. I actually found in all those years two aluminum pennies from the war years. And I had them, you know, and a lot of them I still have, all those coins I collected.
Are those, is there any value to the aluminum pennies?
Well, yeah, but none of it is value like I'm set for life value.
And it's not melted down value. It's really just which collectors would want a silver quarter. Like, I'm sure that's worth more than the quantity of the silver now, right?
Well, in a lot of cases, the coins that I found were so worn that they didn't have any.
Collectors want nice ones?
Yeah, they want nice ones.
Mint in box?
The quality of the coin makes a difference. So mine mostly are just the silver content. Mm. You're always looking, you know, there was one Susan B. Anthony dollar that was worth significantly more than the other ones.
Aren't those 70s era?
Yeah, 79.
But there's a year that, okay.
And I was, but you know, they were made at multiple different mints, and there's one in particular I was never able to find.
Oh yeah, I remember all that, the mint. Like, that's actually something that did fascinate me, like that when I found it, you could look at a coin and find out if it was from
Denver,
and that's, there's not a lot from Denver. Yeah, you're taking me back.
Yeah, so I was into all that, but you know, I was also just a kid. So my coin collection either is, hey, Dad, can I go through your pockets? Or I would go down to the coin shop with my $7 and say, what can I get? You know, and the kindly old numismat would, you know, break off his conversation with the three old men sitting on a pickle barrel and say, well, you could probably get the, you know. So I've got a bunch of Ben Franklin half dollars and stuff like that.
My son had a silver dollar. I can't remember where he got it. Maybe from my grandpa, but my son had a silver dollar that when he was little that he thought was a fun, lucky piece. And then at one point we were crossing some body of water, maybe some lake in the Lake District, and he managed to drop it in such a way that it fell between like the inner hull of the boat and the outer hull of the boat and just someplace that would never be reachable by the hand of man again. And he was just inconsolable that he had left his lucky. And so, of course, I was like, well, I'm sure we can get you a...
I'll buy the boat and take it apart.
That's what we did. I was sawing apart a fiberglass boat. No, I was like, well, there's got to be a coin... So we wound up at some coin store by Northgate, which may still be there and is exactly the kind of weird old guys you'd expect. Probably all reading some kind of weird prepper magazine. And it turned out he was like, what do you need? You just need a silver... Yeah, okay, of course. Like, and he's got some goldfish bowl on the counter. Pick out any of those, you know?
Yeah.
And I kind of felt bad because I had replaced my son's silver dollar, but I also punctured the myth that it was some amazing thing because I could have bought him a worn silver dollar for $3 at any time.
I used to, you know, part of the fun of coin collecting is you just get used, you start to look at your money and look for those little things. Mm-hmm. And over the years, I also found multiple bills that were either silver certificates, you know, it looks like a $20 bill. Somebody found it in their grandfather's, bag
and didn't realize
and spent it for $20.
And what would those be worth?
Oh, they're very well. You know, they're all.
It's condition based.
No, it's everything is worth what somebody will pay for it, and how many Gen Z kids are really into collecting 20th century silver certificates.
This is a market that's going to crash once all the boomers die, just like suburban houses.
And muscle cars, right? Like, who cares? although it's the type of thing that can always come back. It's just that what happened was all these mints and this story, the Kruger Ponds, mints like post offices became aware of stamp collecting and coin collecting. And so they start releasing special editions, proof sets. And the more of those are out there for collectors only, they think this is going to make the hobby more fun. But How many silver quarters come in your pocket change anymore? None of us even have pocket change. Yeah. So the real fun, which was thinking you might find something worth $1,000 in your, you know, in your cash register, is now all about some Franklin Mint. You know, like, remember the 50 state quarters? Those all came out. Who cares about the Arizona state quarter unless you're playing this game of, like,
Gotta catch them all.
Gotta catch them all.
Just turning coins into Pokemons.
Yeah.
I've even lost, when you get old, you kind of lose even the fun game of which penny has my birth year on it. Because, you know, when you're in your 20s or 30s, you know, there's pennies from your era everywhere.
Right.
And then suddenly I look at every penny. How is every penny in my pocket from like 2000? Oh, yeah. Right. Yeah. Pennies don't survive as long as
humans have
do.
Some coins. Let's see what I have here. I have one of these new pennies that's got a crazy 1940s shield on the back that clearly is made of 95% zinc and covered with copper.
The zinc lobby.
It's from 2012 and it has a Denver mint mark. Here's a dime from 2004 and it has a Philadelphia mint mark.
Thank you for listening to our new podcast, What Has John Got in His Pockets?
But here's one. A pretty worn quarter from 1978.
Hey, wow.
This is for the first listener who was born in 1978.
We will send you that quarter.
And then here, and this one has a Denver mint mark, and it is a state quarter from the state of Hawaii. Our friends nearby in Hawaii. And the final coin, a shiny new dime from 2021, minted in Denver. None of those probably worth a penny, except that the 1978 one has more nickel in it than any contemporary nickel, probably.
I like the state and national park quarters.
You do?
It's just, I mean, not for any kind of collector's reason, but just something to look at in your pocket. Hey, yeah. What's going on? You know, it's like, why don't they have magazines in waiting rooms anymore? Why doesn't my quarter have Chimney Rock or Helen Keller on it?
I would give you these two quarters to see if you could tell their difference by feel, but the problem is the old one is softer, right? It's worn, it feels much.
Do you think we should end every entry in the omnibus with you just going through your pockets randomly?
I mean, most of the time, what would I do?
Here's a gum wrapper.
I'd pull out, what's normally in my wallet? There's a dental insurance card, and let's see, a dollar bill from 2013. And three of these weird new Jackson 20s that...
This is just a Letterman talk show bit from the 80s or a Conan one from the 90s.
Yeah, these aren't... I mean, I look at these and think, oh, they're so new and ugly, but this one's from 2009.
At least I have my Kentucky Colonel membership card.
Oh, here. in your wallet?
No, it was just sitting right here. my guess is I have nothing interesting in my wallet. Oh, I have a card that'll give me free popcorn at the Seattle International Film Festival theaters.
Oh, do you qualify?
Only one. I'm a member. Only one punch gun. This is good for four medium popcorns. I don't want to get mugged. Maybe I should not reveal that I carry this on me at all times.
When do you go to a Seattle Film Festival theater?
Oh, they just own the Uptown and the Egyptian.
Oh, I see.
So, honestly, I don't know what they're charging for popcorn, but this is probably the equivalent of
a $50 bill
right here.
I mean, if you want to go through our wallets, I mean, I've got an Orca card and a...
I would like to reveal that I have had a four-punch popcorn card in my Swiss account for decades, and I am looking
and now
to find
selling it in a little Franklin Mint.
I think these are transferable. I don't want to get in trouble with SIF. I hope I can. Do that.
There's my membership card to the EMP. There's my membership card to the Boeing Aircraft Museum.
Do you carry all those with you still? At some point, I had so many. I just have a drawer in my house that's now all my possibly expired membership cards.
Yeah, here's my pop culture membership. Oh, wow, that's going to expire soon.
Why do you own a membership there? I go like every 5 years.
I normally would. And, you know, one time I got a membership to the zoo and I went one time that year and I was like, but you live right by the zoo.
Yes.
I was there and my daughter really likes both those museums, the Airplane Museum and the Museum of Pop Culture. And she said, I want you to get a membership. And I was in the process of telling her no. And then the person behind the counter said, are you John Roderick? And I was like, why? As a matter of fact, I am. And they said, wow.
I was going to ask if all local musicians got a membership to the EMP just to kind of hip the place up.
I suggested that early on. I was like, you guys are going to give memberships to all the local cool kids. And they were like, no, Paul Allen wants us to pay for the electric bill ourselves.
It's a weird thing about super rich people is
they
think everyone else should pay for what they get.
Yeah. They don't want to buy your ticket to the baseball game.
Hey, if you wanted free membership to a rock and roll museum, you should do what Paul Allen does. And build one under the space. Get Frank Gehry to build you one under the Space Needle.
Well, every time I try to collect Jimi Hendrix's guitars, I check my pocket change, and all I ever find are like Green Day guitars, things I don't want at all.
And that concludes the Kruger Millions, entry 693.JB2801, certificate number 15845, in the Omnibus. Omnibus is at Omnibus Project on social media, as we were a product of our time. You can find at Ken Jennings and at John Roderick on various social media platforms, although probably fewer every day for both of us.
What kind of dorks are we? We just had an almost perfect hour-long episode, and then we filled the last 10 minutes of it with
our new spinoff show.
Innate Banter.
That's a pilot episode for What Has John Got in His Pockets Is. That's going to be our new bonus thing. Mm-hmm. That's a Patreon perk. You get to hear that unlistenable coin show.
A quarter or nothing.
If you don't donate.
Oh, if you don't donate, you have to listen to...
If you're
to...
a Patreon donor, you get the addenda shows. If you don't, you get a forced download like the U2 thing.
Yeah, What Has John Got in His Pockets Is.
Of the coin show.
Have you ever looked at my driver's license? My house got broken into years ago, and they stole my wallet because I'm one of those old men that takes his wallet out when he comes home and puts it in a jar.
Yeah.
And so took my wallet, and I was leaving on an international trip the following day. And I had to not only had I been broken into and a bunch of stuff ripped off, but I had to go get a new passport and a new driver's license.
24-hour passport's hard.
Back then it was easier, but it did still cost money and it was a pain in the neck.
And you're saying your picture looks like a stressed crime victim?
Well, that's the thing.
Instead of a cool guy.
So then... when they want you to re-up your driver's license every 10 years, these days you can just do it online and they give you a new one with the copy of the photograph from whatever
you
it was.
You just have to sign a thing saying, I have not gotten any older.
And
the driver's license of Dorian Gray.
Really messed up. Like both thrashed, exhausted, and really mad.
Do you think we could put a close-up of that picture on the Patreon feed for those who donate at the video feed level?
Yeah.
We'll crop out your identifying details.
If you want to freak everybody out.
If you want to see the faded monster that is John before he puts on his makeup.
Yeah.
I had the best picture of myself on my Costco card.
Oh.
It looked like I have never looked as photogenic. Like I look like a movie star on my Costco card.
But those Costco card pictures look like they came from the moon.
That's, I know. I mean, that's probably what helped, honestly. It's very low res, weird lighting. Like that's what it takes to make me look really good, I think.
And you looked really cool.
And I looked great. And I kept it, you know, obviously I kept it for long enough that now I just look 10 years younger, which is the equivalent of being handsome at our age.
Right.
And then at some point, something went wrong. I think I lost my Costco card, or maybe I left my wallet on a plane or something, and I had to go get a new card, and they're like, okay, stand in front of the camera. And I was like,
If you look at my Costco card, my daughter was like, I want to be in it.
Is that allowed?
And I said, you can't be in it. And the person snapped the photo. So my daughter is in there with me.
I guess it's not really like a passport photo. Not smile. 1/4 inch of blank background on all sides.
It's so funny. She's like, she's standing on her tiptoes to get her little face in the bottom of
it. It looks like you just sent them a clipping from a family photo. That's good. So one of many perks on patreon.com/omnibusproject will be John's terrible driver's license photo.
And maybe my cute Costco photo. You can put your Costco photo up there.
Give at the bleary crime victim level. Yeah, I can give my bad Costco photo.
You didn't keep the one that was good.
No, that's the problem. It was lost to time.
Oh, sure.
In whatever accident made me retake the photo. Boo. Email address, theomnibusproject@gmail.com. Send physical items to PO Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington. Send us your social security card. We'll do identity theft with it.
For whatever reason, I heard you say, send us your psilocybin.
Yeah, send us your psilocybin.
And I was like, whoa, Ken.
Send your psilocybin through the mail, which is probably totally legal.
Yeah, but it's the type of thing a dog probably can't smell. A drug dog.
Doesn't it seem like the kind of thing a dog totally could smell?
Maybe they're not trained to smell mushrooms, because why screw up their heads for so little?
I guess just because I can smell mushrooms on a pizza, that makes me think I can smell magic mushrooms, and I have no idea if that's true.
I don't remember magic mushrooms having a very strong smell, but...
Well, neither do regular mushrooms.
But they, you know, they do make you barf if you eat too many of them.
I mean, that's true of any mushroom.
Right. They're all barfers, aren't they?
Well, I mean, if you eat enough mushroom risotto...
Barf.
Sure. I mean, it might be 6 pounds, but at some point, the body just can't process risotto that fast.
Do you think you could eat 6 pounds of risotto?
I'm trying to picture what that volume is like. 6 pounds of risotto.
I mean, it's probably smaller than 5 tons of gold.
But it's not that much. It's 24 quarter pounder patties.
Are quarter pounders really a quarter pound of meat?
Before cooked. So it cooks down.
Right.
That's it. I don't eat. I guess like people can picture like, oh, here's a 16 ounce steak, but I'm terrible at that.
But risotto is full of water and gunk and covered with cheese.
That's true. But it's got lots of cream and cheese in it, things that are not easy to for your body to get through. So tell us how many pounds of risotto you think you could eat.
No one can eat 50 eggs.
Include a video for documentation. In fact, give to the omnibus at the new risotto glutton level, reserved for those who can eat their weight in risotto in a calendar week.
And if you do it for a year, we'll give you a South African pond.
From John's secret stash, because you actually own it.
Yeah, I'm not saying what kind of pond.
You dug it up.
Could be a Kruger pond, could be some other kind of pond.
Koi pond?
Could be a koi pond.
Find the Futurelings online at Reddit, etc. I'd say that's about it. Maybe volunteer at a local food bank or shelter, right. A nonprofit.
That's right. If you have any blankets lying around the house, they're always welcome to be donated to your neighborhood homeless shelter.
If you're having a hard time opening a jar, knock it on the side of the counter.
That's a great advice.
Grease spots on clothing, just put a little dishwashing detergent on them before you put them in the wash. It'll be like magic.
Also, I don't know if you know this, but fizzy water helps get grease stains out of clothes. If you pour a little bit of soda.
Isn't that the household tip cliche? Like every hint from Heloise is like, try sparkling water, try mineral water on your... Turns out it does everything.
Yeah, it does.
It's magic.
My kid opened the fridge the other day and she was like, why is there a box of baking soda in your fridge? I was like, sweetie, it's like a religious thing that people my generation learned from the generation before us. We all have a box of it in there. It's just a sacrament.
No, I think it works. It doesn't work if I believe in it, because I have faith.
Well, that's the thing. I think in order, what they want you to do is change it every 3 months. I mean,
that's big baking soda.
Yeah, mine's been in there 6 years.
They always show the video of it absorbing odor so that like you'll throw away the old one in disgust.
Yeah.
And have to get a new one.
I feel like when I moved from my old house, I just took the box of baking soda and just moved with it. It's got so many terrible odors in it. But
why can't they make the whole fridge out of the box of baking soda? See? See, now we're talking.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how you are still listening to this show. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. But if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if Providence allows, we wish you many goods and cheese and mushrooms and hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the office.